Welcome, everyone. We are thrilled to have you here today for NIAC's Virtual Talks. It is a book launch and a panel discussion, the book, Legal Reasoning Across Commercial Disputes. We hope that you saw the link in the email so that if you wanted to purchase it, please go about and do that. There is a discount code included there. We are thrilled to have an all-star panel today. It's my pleasure to welcome you, Rekha Rangachari, the Executive Director of NIAC. You will be hearing today from, and I'll introduce them in alpha order, Professor Judita Cordero-Moss. She's at the University of Oslo. Melita Hodgson, a partner at Jenner and Block out of the New York office. Professor Stacey Strong. She is at the University of Sydney Law School. Edna Sussman, independent arbitrator and immediate past chair of NIAC. And this is moderated by Lilia Vizova, a partner at Latham & Watkins out of their New York office. We will cover several topics, four in particular through different segments. And with that, allow me to pass the microphone to Lilia to take us through it today. Lilia, please.
Thank you, Rekha, and welcome everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. I hope everyone is settled in with their cups of coffee or glasses of wine, depending on where they are. We have a fabulous panel today, and I'm happy to kick it off with a chat with Stacey about her new book, Legal Reasoning Across Commercial Disputes. Hello, Stacey, welcome. Stacey, even though legal reasoning is a bedrock of dispute resolution, efforts to analyze it in anything resembling a systematic manner have been quite sparse. I think more often than not, we practitioners find ourselves relying on our own personal experience, on word of mouth, on various generalizations we acquire along the way, which is not always necessarily the most precise way to approach it. Your research and your book take on the formidable task of approaching it in an entirely different analytical manner. I think we're very happy to be hearing directly from you about it today. I think to get us started, let's just jump right in. Can you give us a flavor of the research questions, the core research questions that you addressed, and how are they different from the information that's already out in the field?
Absolutely. Thanks so much, both Lilia and to NIAC more generally for launching this book. It did come out a few months ago in the UK and a little bit more recently here in the US, so I thank you for this opportunity to talk about it. I also should recognize the contribution of the AAA ICDR Foundation, which provided grant funding to start this off. The University of Missouri, where I used to be, also helped out with the funding. But without that kind of funding and without the contributions of the arbitrators of the AAA and the ICDR to the foundation, which is a nonprofit, this research could not have taken place. So thank you, and thank you to Edna, who was president or chair of the foundation at that time. I should also say that even though I had grant funding, the AAA and ICDR Foundation did not contribute to the analysis in any way. It's completely independent. So having that scholarly background in place, the research questions that I was most interested in dealing with involved the longstanding presumption among some people that arbitration is a second-class form of justice. We see this a lot in domestic contexts, not so much in the international realm, where a variety of mechanisms and procedures exist to show that international commercial arbitration is the preferred and perhaps better option than domestic litigation or litigation in national courts. But I really wanted to test that out. And much of the empirical research that had existed focused only on domestic arbitration and focused more on perceptions and not really on legal reasoning. And in my view, the core question why people think arbitration is a second-class form of justice is a presumption that the legal reasoning is second-class, that it is only based on equity or not based in precedent in any way. So I really wanted to test that out. And when we talk about the methodology, you'll see that it's a big study. And I decided at the same time, because I'm never going to do such a big study again, I should also look at differences across the domestic and international realm or divide, as well as the common law and civil law divide. So I'm basically looking at three different questions. The difference, if any, in legal reasoning between judges and arbitrators, between domestic and international disputes, and between common law and civil law disputes, only in the commercial realm.
Got it.
Understood. And then, well, let's pick up. You mentioned the methodology, and I think that's actually a great segue into the next thing I want to talk about. I think one of the most striking things about the book is how data-driven it is. You know, I think there are a lot of jokes about lawyers and math, but, you know, there is a lot of math in the book, and it's all quite useful. So can you tell us about your research methodology and why it was important for you to conduct the analysis that way?
The nice part about the math is I did it all, and you don't have to. So basically, people just see the results, and so don't be afraid of the book in that sense. So the way I look at things is from a scientific background. Instead of relying on anecdote, instead of relying on kind of general unconscious biases or conscious biases, let's look at the data. So I created a triple-pronged approach to investigating this question of legal reasoning. And the reason I use three different types of analyses is to capture different types of information, but also to triangulate and kind of cross-reference at the same time, because one of the ways to determine whether a empirical study is accurate is, one, to look at how it's constructed, but second, to see whether it is repeatable. And again, I don't expect others to use my exact same methodology, although it would be interesting to have other people do this research, maybe in other languages or other types of settings, maybe instead of commercial realms, you know, do it in the investment realm. But the three prongs that I used were a international survey, a series of semi-structured interviews, and a coded analysis of, or qualitative analysis, analysis of original awards and decisions. And just to expand a bit on those, the international survey was quite long. It had approximately 70 questions that not everybody answered because it had switch coding. But the questions there looked at a variety of different aspects of legal reasoning, going from the use of legal authorities to the use of what I call factual authorities or evidence, looking at how arbitrators and judges go through the reasoning process, how they go through the drafting process, which is different. And in that analysis, I really was trying to kind of set a baseline for the subsequent analyses. And this was looking very much at a picture of where things stood. There were well over 400 respondents from around the world, so it was quite significant on its own merits. The second aspect was semi-structured interviews of 20 people, only 20 because they take a long time to do and a long time to analyze. The survey was statistically kind of studied, whereas interviews cannot be statistically studied. They're just information. But many of the questions that I asked were in the same general realm as the interview, as the surveys, which allowed me to triangulate immediately and see whether there was conformity between the answers. And the interviews allowed arbitrators and judges from around the world to give me their answers in their own words, and so would identify any holes that might have existed in the methodology for the survey. Happily, it turned out I did not really have any huge gaping holes, a few a little bit around the edges, but that was very nice because I had immediate confirmation of consistency. And then because people can, not only do they lie to the interviewer consciously or unconsciously in order to look good, same thing with surveys, they give you the answer that they think you want to give. I did an empirical analysis of judicial decisions and arbitral awards, unpublished awards in the sense that they weren't from a denatured award from an institution. Instead, they were attached to court filings in the United States, which takes a while to find them, but you can find them. So they were in the original. And I was only looking at trial-level decisions. I looked at, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but domestic and international decisions from U.S. courts, from Canadian courts, and from English courts, because Canadian courts, of course, are common law, and I should clarify, I was looking only at Quebec, which is a civil law jurisdiction within a common law country, and then the other two were common law jurisdictions, and then the arbitral awards were also both domestic and international. So some of the questions tried to track what I had seen in the earlier parts of the book, but of course you can't get to people's perceptions in an analysis of awards and decisions.
Well, just to pick up on something that you said you looked at trial court decisions, and I believe you mentioned that in the book, and that the reason it was important to do that is because that allowed you to analyze the importance of fact and factual evidence, which is something that you wouldn't see in appellate court decisions. I mean, factual evidence features quite prominently in your research, and you know, the juxtaposition between that and legal reasoning made me think about this expression we sometimes have in the U.S., which is that, you know, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but if the law is on your side, you argue the law. If the facts are on your side, you argue the facts. If neither the facts nor the law are on your side, you pound on the table and yell really loudly. And you know, I'm just curious whether your analysis found that any of these pieces, each of which are constituent pieces of legal reasoning, were more important than the other, so to speak. You know, is it facts? Is it law? Is it equities, as you said earlier? Or is it, you know, something else like pounding on the table?
Absolutely. And I did specifically look at the equity question because a lot of the misperceptions of arbitration is that arbitrators only decide on equity. That was absolutely not the case in either the statistical studies of the surveys or the quantitative studies of the awards. That did not appear to be the case. Even with unreasoned awards, we seem to see some reasoning going on there. But across the board, judges and arbitrators were saying in commercial disputes, the facts are the most important part. Typically, the law is very well settled, which is one of the problems I had in finding U.S. cases at the trial level dealing with commercial disputes. There just were very few, literally like 7 in a 3-year span across the entire United States, which is insane. So facts seem to be the big thing. And the other aspect that I thought was really important when constructing this is there's very little empirical information out there about what types of facts, what types of evidence are most important to legal decision makers. And I did dig down into that with some amount of detail and came up with some very interesting answers. One of the things I found is that there isn't a huge distinction between judges and arbitrators. Instead, it tends to be much more personalized, that even within the spectrum of judges or the spectrum of arbitrators, people have their own views on what is important. So the concept of arbitration as allowing you to know more about what your decision maker finds important, and that was one of the very early rationales for arbitration, actually holds true. You will know more about what your decision maker wants, and you'll be able to choose that person, whereas in courts, of course, you just get who you get. And they're all very good and conscientious, but you don't have that ability to select. So long answer, hopefully I answered your question.
You did. And actually, just to, you know, taking us back to right where we started in terms of the core assumption that you tested, whether arbitration is the second class form of dispute resolution relative to arbitration. And, you know, you may have answered that in several different ways already, but just what was your overarching takeaway on that question?
The big takeaway for the main question of is there a huge difference or even a discernible difference between legal reasoning in court and in arbitration, the answer was a resounding no. There are little areas where statistically there might be some difference, but overall there is not this kind of clear-cut distinction that the critics of arbitration seem to laud. I wasn't sure whether laud would come out through the internet as well as in my head. So that's really good news for commercial arbitration. We are a really legitimate means of deciding commercial disputes. Now we just need to get the news out there to our critics. In terms of the distinction between national and international, I was surprised. I thought that international commercial arbitration would be a lot more formalistic than domestic arbitration, but that did not turn out to be the case. Granted, I was looking primarily at U.S. domestic awards because of the way the study was structured, not intentionally, but just that's how it's structured. So maybe there's difference in other countries, but that was a little surprising. And there is also some areas of distinction between common law and civil law, as one would expect, but not as much as has traditionally been understood. And some scholars have recently been saying the two systems are converging. And I found that to be true. There are areas of difference and areas of convergence. And again, picking your arbitrator or judge will be the important part.
Well, Stacey, thank you so much. This is really such a tremendously impressive project, both by way of just scale and magnitude, but also just in terms of the instructive and innovative information that you were able to elicit. We are actually going to dig into some of these core aspects of legal reasoning that you mentioned with some of our panelists. So with that, I will invite all of them to rejoin our Zoom and show their faces. A good place to start is one of the pieces that you spoke about, Stacey, and that is awards. I think for us practitioners, often the only indicator of our decision makers' legal reasoning, be it the judge or an arbitrator, is going to be the actual decision or award, whichever way it goes. I think it's fair to say that parties' perception of the legitimacy or quality of an award of a decision will often turn on whether it goes their way, unsurprisingly. But I think it also turns on the parties' expectations and what they expected from their judge or their arbitrator. So that is a fascinating topic all on its own. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Judithia to get us started on our first segment, which is going to speak about the drafting of awards and parties' expectations in legal reasoning across commercial disputes. Judithia.
Thank you very much, Laila. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the very interesting discussion that we just listen to, and thank you for asking this very, very interesting question. What are the parties' expectations in arbitration, and where does arbitration find its legitimacy? Now, I'm going to talk about international arbitration, international commercial arbitration. And I think I can see that there is an expectation of uniformity. And in uniformity, there is also a legitimacy for arbitration. The parties believe that by choosing arbitration, international arbitration, they can avoid all the peculiarities of the different national legal systems, and they can reach this uniformity. And how can they reach it? By applying soft law instruments or by exercising their party autonomy, and by assuming that there are no limits to their party autonomy. So the question is, do the parties really obtain this uniformity that they expect? And my impression, which was actually confirmed by some very interesting tables that I saw in Stacey's book, my impression is that the parties, they see uniformity through the glasses of their own expectations. So I am expecting the world to look like I believe that it should look like, and the other party expects the world to look like they are expecting it to look like. So I would like to make a couple of examples. When only I would like to show that these expectations of uniformity, they do not really manage to. They are not really realistic, both when it comes to the procedural aspect and when it comes to the substance of the case. When it comes to the procedural aspects, you would say, of course, there is the lex arbitri, it's national procedural law, but you know that the national procedural law gives a lot of room to party autonomy. They only have default rules mainly, so there is a huge room for soft law and uniformization through the soft law. But we have the example of the IBA rules on evidence that now have found a competitor in the Prague rules on evidence, showing that also the soft law doesn't really manage to overcome the difference in the legal cultures. You have two different soft law instruments, and that does not really give so much uniformity. So this was in respect of the procedure, and in respect of the substance, you have also expectations of uniformity. You think that the arbitral tribunal will decide on the basis of the contract and without being too formal and party autonomy. If the parties only write sufficiently clearly what they want in their contract, then they will get what they want. But there again, you have two different approaches, at least two different approaches, which can coincide with what we heard about the difference between the common law and the civil law. The arbitral tribunal may have a different understanding of its own role. Under some legal culture, as an arbitrator, you are supposed to only listen to what the parties are telling you and try to understand what the contract wanted and apply accurately the contract. Under other legal cultures, you don't think that your function is simply to accurately apply the contract. You think that you should actually be more active. You should construct the contract. You should understand what is better for the parties in spite of what is written in the terms of the contract. So these are two very, very brief examples showing that depending on which legal culture you come from, depending on the color that your glasses have, you will be expecting a uniformity in the decision, procedural decision or decision on the merits of the arbitral tribunal. You will be expecting something that is reflecting your own world. And I'm not saying that this is a disadvantage of arbitration, not at all, actually. I'm only saying that the parties should be more aware of the fact that there is not only one single truth out there in the world. And there I'm back to what Stacey said. The crucial thing is actually the selection of the arbitrators. So you should know what kind of arbitrators you should look for, and you should look for them. So I think I will stop here
That's a great point. It sounds like parties are looking for uniformity, but of course uniformity means different things to different people depending on their background, and it all ties back to what Stacey spoke about earlier, that at least in arbitration you do have a certain degree of choice as to the type of legal background your decision maker has, and you get to at least have some say in the matter. Meli, do you have is your experience different? You know, since you come from a common law perspective, so I wonder how that compares to what Judith talked about.
Well, I thought what was interesting, I picked up on the word uniformity also, and thinking about it just in terms of the world that I spend most of my arbitration time in, which is investment arbitration, where the buzzword there is really consistency. And I think there's similarities there, and it goes to the expectations that the different parties will have. We know that, speaking about legitimacy, that the investment arbitration world has gone, I think is still going through a crisis regarding its legitimacy. We have movements now, we have negotiations, working group three of UNCITRAL to sort of redefine the process, at least the procedural part. And some would say, however, that if you're looking for consistency, which is one of the goals of that process, you also then have to reform the substantive part of the substantive provisions, because simply doing a procedural change won't help. And we know that in the case of investment arbitration, the audience is much broader than perhaps the limited parties sitting in a particular room during a hearing. But I think in some ways, they're very similar. If you're looking at, let's say, in commercial arbitration, a major multinational who frequently uses arbitration, let's say, that kind of a party also has certain needs, certain goals in terms of expectations. And, for a line counsel or an in-house counsel, general counsel, to be able to explain to a board, what happened and why, you need good, solid reasoning. I think coming out of the common law tradition, first of all, briefs are very small or limited by a certain amount of pages, to a certain amount of pages generally, and the decisions are also fairly succinct. Now, you can't really do that in arbitration because you don't have, sort of the pleadings are written a certain way and you don't have the same kind of record, so you have to go through and talk about all the different elements, or all the pleadings, in essence. But particularly, again, going back to commercial arbitration, a similarity with investment arbitration would be that if you have an award, if it's a continuing business relationship, or one of the parties has the same model contract, for example, that it uses with all other parties or all parties, period, oftentimes, whether specifically in the specific dispute or for general purposes, the contracts call for, and then I see this in major concession contracts, call for, if there's a dispute, the sort of interpretation, the law of that contract becomes what the arbitrators determine it to be. So then it's particularly important for the parties to understand, in particular for the party that drafts and uses this particular model contract, to understand how the arbitrators or arbitrator got to the point that they did. And so I think that in some ways the expectations are the same across the board, and I think more and more we're seeing an even more of a commonality between sort of a civil law tradition and a common law tradition. It just is probably true that you get to it maybe through a slightly different process.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And, you know, one thing that I thought about as you were talking, of course, another big distinction between investment and commercial arbitration is that investment arbitration, as in a court case, you would typically, you know, your award, your decision will typically be public, whereas in commercial arbitration, not so often. Melit, either you or Judita, do either of you have a view on whether and how the public nature or the publication of awards and decisions influences the legal reasoning and drafting that go into those decisions? And Melit, I'll start with you. Since you're the one that made me think of this question.
Sure. I have to think, and Stacey can check us on this, but I have to think that if someone knows something is going to be public, that you may, and particularly, you know, different institutions have different level of scrutiny in terms of how they want an award to read. So I think you're always obviously, or should be, thinking about the ultimate users, thinking about the possibility of annulment, therefore the reason that you need to be clear. But I do think the public nature of it, in investment arbitration, is partly what leads to some more detailed analysis, the need to sort of cross-check every argument or at least say something effective. Yes, I actually did read and consider all of those, but here's why I come out this way. So I do think it influences it, and you know the ICC is going towards the process of publishing awards, and I have a feeling that will also influence that process will influence what we see in terms of award drafting.
I can only subscribe to that actually, knowing that someone else, not only the parties or possibly a court, will look at your award, but also the rest of the world will. It can trigger a lot of good sides and not so good sides in the arbitrator who is writing, because you may be tempted to show how much you know, to show how good an arbitrator you are for the next clients, the next parties who want to appoint you. So it's not necessarily an incentive to be succinct and to the point.
You know, I will say the New York City Bar Association did a report several years ago, long before the ICC said that they were going to be publishing awards, you know, on this subject. And there were very few institutions at the time that did publish, you know, and this is one of the things they talked about. But I think one of the other things that's going to be quite significant is the extent to which it's going to be used as precedent, not only for procedural points, which are obvious since they're perhaps in some respects sui generis for arbitration, you know, but actually for the development of the law. And there are certainly, you know, certain aspects of contracts, for example, where there is the same issue can come up in many different contexts. I mean, in the U.S., for example, is it consequential damages or not, depending on the nature of the relationship between the parties, for example, or the limitations of liability clauses, which you see in so many cases. So are we going to beginning to look to arbitration awards for precedent as well as court decisions? Will be very interesting, actually, to see how it goes. And are the courts going to start looking to arbitration awards, too? That'll be kind of interesting to see if they view us as significant. And there are certainly some areas where most of the work actually is done in arbitration and not in court. So they might well look the other way because that's where there's precedent. So I think that will be an equally significant and interesting development to watch.
If I can just say one last thing on that, because that prompted me to remember it, and that is, I think it was an English judge just a couple of years ago who complained that arbitration was essentially creating law that is not public and it's not going through the judiciary. So I think there are concerns about that.
That's part of the bias that I was hoping to address, that's not a bad form. And also, there's not a lot of precedent out there. And one of the other things I should say about the concept of why there were so few cases dealing with contract and commercial matters, at least in the United States, I went back and looked at the number or proportion, because we're more litigious society now, but the proportion of cases involving contract or other matters around the time of the Pound Conference in the United States in the late 1970s, which is when ADR and arbitration started to explode, and right before the renovation of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which also changed the procedural landscape. And it was still a very small number. So it is not evil arbitration that is taking these cases out of the judicial system. It's something else. These parties either want to settle or they want to be in arbitration, but it is not evil arbitration stealing the common law away from the courts. Sorry, Melinda, it was a really good point that you made, and I just had to jump in.
No worries.
Well, no, thanks, everyone. That was really interesting. And, you know, I just wanted to pick up on something Judith said, which is that this instinct perhaps on the part of decision makers not to be succinct in order to, you know, show off everything they know, that actually dovetails very nicely with one of the points that Stacey made in her book, which actually had to do with her core findings pertaining to facts, meaning that facts are perhaps the most important aspect of reasoning that drives commercial disputes. I think, you know, we often find, as practitioners, I think decision makers often find, arbitrators do, that parties have this really potentially bad instinct to just do this massive data dump on the arbitrator, put in front of them every piece of fact or evidence that could conceivably take the dispute their way, no matter how tenuous. It sounds, Stacey, like that's something that you heard pretty uniformly across the board was not something that decision makers were big fans of. And, you know, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Edna, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the importance of factual reasoning and evidence in the legal reasoning process.
All right, thank you. And thank you all for participating. And Stacey, thank you for doing this really amazing empirical work on this very important subject. So we all thank you. So I had to give a talk a few years ago, actually, on how one can be persuasive in arbitration. And one can't do better than Aristotle, right? Ethos, pathos, and logos. So ethos, obviously, you have to be honest with the tribunal and have credibility. That's an obvious one. But then you have pathos, which is the story, and logos, which is the law. And how do we balance those? And how should advocates go about, are they going to emphasize the law or are they going to emphasize the fact, even when the law is better for them? How important are the facts? So as Stacey's survey demonstrated, I think across all of the methodologies, facts were more important. You know, I should mention, we were talking about other people doing surveys and doing work in this area. So I did a survey several years ago with 400 respondents. And one question was, do you regard yourself as influenced more by the facts or the law in making your decision? Law, 3.5%. Facts, 25.3%. And both equally, 71.2%. So, you know, overwhelmingly, facts were much more important than law. And those that have kind of studied how the brain works and how people are persuaded, there's a whole school of thought on storytelling that your mind really works in story. So you really need to create a story that is sympathetic, which will make the decision maker want to go your way if they can find a way to get there that is consistent with the law. So I think, you know, advocates know that. I think they're all working on their story all the time to try to make it very credible and motivating. So, of course, it does have to be consistent with the law. I thought it was interesting that Stacey said that equity itself was not really a dominant factor. in the sense that the arbitrators weren't just applying equity to get to the result that they wanted, and neither were the judges. It really was very much a fact and law-based system, which I think should give people a lot of reassurance about the arbitration world, where there is some perception, perhaps inaccurately, I'm glad to see, that they're motivated by equity and not sticking with the facts and the law. But I thought some of the specifics that came out of Stacey's work was quite interesting, and I thought I could highlight a few of them. So along the lines of what Lilia was saying, one of the arbitrators in the interview said, open quote, throwing in the kitchen sink makes it harder to get to the right outcome. Well, we know all that, right? We all know that. If you're drowning in all this stuff, it's really, really hard to parse it out. It does make it more difficult. It was the question that was directed in the survey aspect of the methodology, where the question specifically excluded documents that were read during the hearing. So those were a given. I would hope that every arbitrator is reading all the documents that were actually flagged for them, either at the hearing or in the submissions, the written submissions. So this is with respect to the rest of it. Those piles and piles of other documents that are put into the record, it showed that only 30 to 59% of those documents were read in full. So really, I think it would be, counsel would be well advised to reduce the quantity and work on quality of the submissions that they make. You know, I will say one of the things I do, and I think others do as well, is to ask them to give me the 20 most important documents in their case with their pre-hearing submission when they kind of know what it's going to be. You know, those 40 documents tell you an awful lot about the case, and that way you know what to zero in on, in addition to all the others, but at least you can focus on those the most. I thought there was some interesting questions about when arbitrators read the submissions and when they read all those documents. So do they read them before the hearing, during the hearing, after the hearing? Pretty uniformly during and after. So people are paying attention at the hearing, and people are certainly rereading the documents to write the award or to review a draft of the award. But are they reading it beforehand? You know, this gets back to the quantity. If you haven't narrowed down the field to a manageable number, they might be waiting to some extent to see what you flag at the hearing, and they're not going to read the 3,000 documents that you put in, or even the 800 documents that are in the record. So one really needs to think about how to make sure that what you want to have read before the hearing is actually read. And so you shouldn't be waiting for the arbitrator to flag the most important documents. I mean, counsel ought to be stepping up to that plate and volunteering it and making sure that what they want to get read is read. Another interesting area that I thought Stacey flagged where there were some differences was in the area of what evidence was most persuasive. And this kind of takes us back a little bit to Guidita's point and actually Melita's point, you know your audience and what is the expectation and how are some arbitrators perhaps different in a personal sense. So they're all doing the reasoning, the law, the facts, but they have personal predilections based on the kind of thing that Guidita was talking about, you know, the cultural background that they come to it with. So this is really focused more on evidence and the substantive law that Guidita flagged. But for example, there was a somewhat marked difference between how much weight was given to oral testimony by witnesses at the hearing between civil law and common law jurisdictions, between U.S. judges and people in the civil law. And so, you know, that's not really such a big surprise, given what we all know about civil law being more motivated by the written word. But yeah, I guess one anecdote is sort of useful. So I had one case. It was a very large case, and there was a civil law arbitrator, and there was a common law arbitrator, but had been living in a civil law jurisdiction for the last 30 years. So we walk in for our deliberations, and they had not read the transcript of the hearing because it didn't seem very important to them. And there were some incredibly significant statements that had been made at that hearing, which, you know, I looked at my notes and I read over the transcript, and yes, those things really had been said. So they were certainly prepared to listen to that, but it was, you know, it was almost surprising how little attention was paid to the oral testimony. So I think, you know, as you are selecting your arbitrator, and I'm not saying everybody's the same, you know, they're not. Across all jurisdictions and all cultures, you know, everybody is not the same. But it's something to think about. If the oral testimony is going to be important, if you think the cross-examination really is going to make a difference, there really are going to be things that come out that are going to be crucial to your case, you know, think about that even as early as the selection of the arbitrator. I mean, as Stacey pointed out, the whole, part of the whole point of this whole exercise is to look at that kind of issue. There was a similar disparity to some extent in how much weight was given to expert testimony at the hearing. And the civil law practitioners were more likely to credit that testimony more more heavily than common law. And so one wonders why. So is it because of the tradition of having tribunal-appointed experts? I don't think the question was limited to tribunal-appointed experts. So one will have that impact regardless of whether it's a tribunal expert or not. So that would be part of it, more trust in experts in general. And then I was thinking, you know, maybe it goes back to this, you know, the half-speed dimensions, the work that was done on sort of social culture. And if you look at what he refers to as power distance, you know, it's sort of in some cultures, people that are in more authoritarian positions, higher in the hierarchy, are really listened to more as opposed to people of lower status. And if you look, for example, at France, I looked it up, France versus U.S. So U.S. is 68. I'm sorry, the other way around. France is 68 and the U.S. is 40. So, right, with 68, the people in France, generally speaking, this is a broad generalization and obviously not true of all individuals, you know, are just much more likely to be hierarchical in their thinking and give more respect to somebody who speaks with authority, as an expert would. So again, in your selection of the arbitrator, is this something that should be considered? Is expert testimony going to be extremely important to your case, maybe not only on damages, but even on liability itself? And so, you know, think about the individual and how you think he or she might value the expert testimony if it's really important to your case. So I thought there were, you know, those are just a few of the little tidbits that I picked up from Stacey's book. There is a wealth of information there, a very detailed survey. And as she said, there's a lot more that I think can be gotten out of the work that she has done to tease out more reflections and more conclusions. But I just want to end with another quote from one of the interviews that she conducted in terms of the importance of factual presentation and how one cannot overemphasize it. And so he said the fact citations, because there was a very heavy reference to facts in the citations as opposed to law. The fact citations anchor the logic of the award, right? And I think that's absolutely true. If the facts don't gel with the conclusion, obviously the whole award doesn't really gel, and it doesn't persuade, and it doesn't help make the loser understand why they lost, which is really an essential part of writing the award, so that the loser does understand why they lost. So facts anchor the logic.
Well, thanks, Edna. That is fascinating. And I think it's really interesting to hear how your own experience just dovetails and, you know, to borrow Stacey's word, just triangulates with the research that she did. I think what you mentioned on drafting the awards and making the loser understand why they lost, I think that segues very nicely into our next segment, which is a topic we touched about a couple of times already, which is writing with one's audience in mind. And I think that's something that, you know, we obviously all do as counsel. I think that's something I imagine arbitrators and judges also do as decision makers. So with that, I'll turn it over to Melody to talk about writing with one's audience in mind, a topic that you already touched upon a little bit earlier, and how that dynamic impacts the reasoning and drafting process.
Sure. And, you know, sort of starting where I ended off, if you've got, you know, if you're looking at it from a commercial arbitration perspective, although oftentimes you're dealing with a state party anyway in commercial arbitration, or not often, but I think it's a growing percentage of cases. Then you do need to think about the fact that the audience is not only going to be the lawyers who have appeared in front of you, or the representatives who have appeared in front of you, but you have an audience. Sometimes, if it's a corporation, it could still be thousands. If you're looking at investment arbitration or a commercial arbitration involving a state-owned entity, for example, you're looking at an audience potentially of millions. And, you know, one has to, the lawyers have to sort of understand and digest, you know, particularly if it's an unfavorable result, understand and digest how to communicate that to people at their different points, because they're also going to be perhaps people who were going to be a little tone deaf or don't want to hear what the result is, or only focus on, frankly, the negative part of the result, as opposed to maybe there's something in there that is educational and useful for everybody going forward. But so I think the issue in this, one of the thoughts that came to mind, and it's probably more relevant in investment arbitration, but again, it's not necessarily always. For example, if you have a case that arises out of the denial of an environmental permit, and you know, basically ends up that the state you know, violated fair and equitable treatment or something like that, you then have to explain that to the people who live in and around the area where, you know, it's possible then for someone else or for this entity to get its environmental permit. I don't think things move fast enough for investment arbitration for that to actually be the case, but you never know. But the audience, what's going to be published, let's say, in a 250-word article in a newspaper talking about a loss is that, you know, you've got these foreign arbitrators, normally they're foreign, who have said that, you know, those people should have, who were going to pollute the area, you know, have to now be paid millions and millions of dollars out of you poor taxpayers' money because denying them a permit apparently was wrong. So that audience is not really going to want to be hearing what, you know, why that is, because they obviously feel that the result is different. And you compound that if you have situations, which you often do in the case of investment arbitration, at least, you know, very poor sectors, very poor of the economy, people who were, you know, barely making it. And now you're saying that, you know, something that at least affects their, could potentially affect their health, you know, was wrong, and the state should now take more money out of coffers to pay for that. So it's that kind of an audience, realizing that your audience is going to be broader than just the people in the room or the people who are approving something. So, you know, it's the kind of thing where it pays to sort of be thinking about that. And again, if you're looking at it from the commercial arbitration perspective, it still is going to have, you're going to have audiences that internally that need to understand, okay, how do I go forward, whether it be with a commercial relationship that was going to go forward anyway, or how do I go forward so that this doesn't happen to us again. So it is, I think, just really critical, and this is something that's touched upon also by stating many different, from many different interviews, that, you know, understanding that audience is so critical and so important. Say the same thing twice. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you so much for that. And, you know, it was really valuable to hear your perspective from an investment arbitration angle, because that is actually one thing that Stacey's book and her research did not touch upon, even though she identified it as a potentially fruitful area of future research, which, you know, brings me to something, a question I wanted to pose to all of you, including you, Stacey. You know, the book, and I'll start with you, the book identifies a couple of areas of potential follow-up research. And I was just wondering, kind of, what is your take on what are the, you know, the most surprising outcomes or the most surprising things that you learned as you did your research and that you think are worth looking into further for, you know, future projects like yours?
So I'll talk really fast. You may have seen in the chat, there's somebody's doing renovations upstairs and there's drilling, but it stopped for a moment. So apologies if they start. So there are areas where I think that we need to do more research and areas where I found some surprising conclusions. And the areas where we need to do more research, it would be great to do similar research with respect to investment. I do have a few investment awards that my research assistants didn't appreciate. They were investment awards because they were contract as opposed to treaty-based arbitrations. So I might be able to churn some numbers on those and compare to what I've done in the commercial realm. I really want to look more into finding unpublished judicial decisions and analyzing those in comparison to arbitral awards, because The arbitral awards that I have are those that are being confirmed or vacated in the United States or enforced, attempts to enforce them, which means that they might be the most difficult. They might be the most troubling because otherwise the parties would just pay up. We don't know, but you know, it could be financial issues as opposed to legal issues, but they're the more questionable ones, whereas the published judicial decisions are the best. The judges probably knew it was going to be published, so they wrote their best opinion. Every jurisdiction has different rules about what judicial decisions are published and which are not. Some publish all, some publish very few, and we don't know what those criteria are. So finding the unpublished decisions and comparing them would be really, really insightful and would be much more on an equal playing field when comparing across the judicial and arbitral divide. There are a number of surprising outcomes, which I won't go into, but one thing we've talked a lot about today is this concept that of knowing your arbitrator, which we already want to do. But one of the things that I suggest in the last chapter of the book is creation of a questionnaire that we could offer either institutionally to arbitrators or individually. If you're a repeat player as a client or even counsel, you might come up with a questionnaire that asks about the style of legal reasoning, not in specifics, because of course that would be violating the conflicts of interest and improper with respect to the selection of the arbitrator, but generally, what types of evidence are most persuasive? What do you want to see in terms of the quantum of documents, et cetera? There's issues about whether that information should be shared with both sides, but that could really go towards increasing the efficiency and efficacy of arbitration if we understood more about how individual arbitrators decide matters. And the reason I didn't do that myself in the book is A, I ran out of space, and B, it is of course potentially fraught with issues about conflicts and pre-deciding cases. But I think it's a really interesting concept. If we are going to make arbitration the place where you know who you're presenting to, why don't we make that more transparent with respect to legal reasoning? So I'll just kind of leave it there and let the others come up with their suggestions.
Well, thank you, Stacey. That was great. And, you know, I'm going to pose the same question, but in a slightly different format to our panelists. Edna, I'll start with you. In terms of the issues we talked about today, all of which are potentially highly consequential to reasoning and outcome of commercial disputes, what would you like to see more research and information on? Because, you know, it would be potentially most helpful to you in your own practice.
I don't know about the last part, but one thing that struck me in reading through some of this material is the question of the sequence of the reasoning. So does the arbitrator start with, you know, here's the law, kind of the Germanic model, but here's the law, here are the elements that have to be proved to establish a claim under that legal theory. Here are the facts that are not in dispute with respect to that claim. Here's what's left to decide. All right, I have five fact issues I need to decide. Open, shut, that wins. As opposed to you start with the facts and you develop the facts carefully, and then you look to the law and see how the law fits with the facts. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out what I do. I'm having a little trouble figuring it out. I would think that I do the facts, but certainly when I'm writing the award, you know, the first thing I write after I do the facts section, you know, here's the law, and then apply the law to the facts in that sequence. So maybe that's a silly question, but I think it might really drive how people reason and maybe even in some cases how they come out. So exactly how that gets pursued, I don't know. And since I'm confused about myself, I don't know what the answer is. But I think it's an interesting question, and I think it really could be leading to different results with different people and how they approach it. And it seemed like people did approach it differently in the interviews. There were some who did it one way and some who did it the other. So to me, that would be an interesting question to pursue if it's doable as a sort of statistical survey kind of question.
Well, we'll leave that to Stacey, but as to whether it's doable in a kind of systemic and an analytical kind of way. But Melanie, the same question to you in terms of what would you like to see more information on?
Information? I think it really, for me, goes to seeing more sort of uniformity. I'm not sure how you run into a lot of problems, like as Stacey, I think, has alluded to, when you try to sort of say, okay, this is how they actually do it and get to it. But maybe the sort of end result of that is something that I think we could better understand. And maybe that goes to just having more uniformity in the way these in the way the findings and the conclusions are presented, because I think that if you start to understand this, particularly when we're going to see more awards being published, I think it's important to be able to look almost formulaically to this is why this is why that, this is why the other. And so at least, you know, I think it's interesting what Edna said about the way you approach it. Hopefully what we can get to is not necessarily having to completely understand the process of the arbitrators getting there, but to have it be more clear once the arbitrators are there, sort of the presentationally, and obviously the presentation is substantive, of how and why, in essence, we got there. I do think there could be more done on that.
Okay, that's great. And Judith, how about you?
Oh, well, everything that has been said is extremely interesting and promising. I personally have been playing with the idea for years, been playing with the idea of doing something very similar to what Stacey has done. Congratulations. But on a slightly different level, which is a little bit along the lines that that Edna was mentioning earlier. The distinction between facts and law is not necessarily always so clear. I have the impression that there is a very blurred line there, particularly when it comes to the authority of the evidence that has been produced. Depending on how you are used to thinking, depending on what you think is the function of an arbitral tribunal, as I was saying earlier, depending on all the legal imprinting that you have from your own background, you may think that a fact is not, you have the contract that says you can terminate if there is a default. And then you have the fact there was a default. So you have the contract and you have the fact. But depending on how, what kind of legal imprinting you have, you may think that that fact is not only it's not enough to observe that the contract was breached. You have to find out whether there was good faith. You have to find out whether there was a duty of loyalty. You have to find out whether the other party had some obligation to, I don't know, mitigate or whatever. So you are adding to the facts some implicit legal standards that are going to influence your decision. And you're not going to write it in your decision, not because you don't want to, because you think that's obvious. You think that this is the way you think as a lawyer. And but then this is the way you think as a lawyer if you were educated in that particular system. In another legal system, you would not expect to have that kind of importance to the good faith or whatever other surrounding circumstances. So I think this unconscious influence of the legal tradition on the interpretation of the contract, on the assessment of the facts, and on the conclusion, without having been made explicit, that is something. But of course, it's very difficult to write a questionnaire where you ask to an arbitrator, what do you really think without knowing that you're thinking that? So it requires a lot of self-assessment, that psychoanalysis that probably not everyone is willing to do. But that is something that I think could be very interesting and useful, actually, to clarify a little bit about these expectations of uniformity and so on that we were talking about in the beginning.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think it will be a fascinating question whether it's possible to design a study, a questionnaire, whatever it may be, that that would elicit that type of information without necessarily obviously eliciting that type of information. But, you know, to go to Stacey's point from the very beginning about the importance of methodology that's actually, you know, replicable and valid and, you know, can kind of withstand scrutiny from a methodological perspective. which, you know, Stacey's book certainly does. So we're you know, this has been tremendously useful. And like I said, it's just been really fascinating to hear from what you have found from, you know, an empirical perspective, but then also to listen and hear from our panelists how it dovetails from their own experiences. You know, I will say my own impression is that it does sound like a lot of what we see in our practice, either as counsel or as arbitrators, you know, I think a lot was confirmed, Stacey, by what you found, but there was also a lot of very, very interesting and, you know, potentially significant departures from certain assumptions or generalizations we may hold. So thank you. Thank you for your contribution to the field. It was really useful. Thank you to our panelists. I do think we're right on schedule. So Rekha, I hope I get brownie points for that, that we are right on schedule with the conclusion of kind of our plan program. I do think we have a few minutes for audience questions. So, you know, we welcome those. Feel free to use the Q&A or the chat function to post that to our panelists. Or Rekha, let me know if there's anything I'm missing and in terms of what we should do next.
We are right on schedule. Thank you so much to each of you for sticking to our tight timelines. I think we'd really like to sort of open it up to the delegates. I know there's been a very active chat, thanks to Stacey for responding to it. But and then if there's some silence, you know, even Stacey, to just delve in a little bit more into what's to come and the path forward as you see it with all of the methodology you've been shaping. You know, will there be more on investor state and the like? But maybe you can tee it off sort of what do you expect to come of this as people read it and they parse through it while we wait for more questions from the audience.
Well, what I'm really hoping is that it is taken up not only within the arbitral community, but that it's also considered within the civil procedures / evidence / what we call in the state's fed courts. That people from other disciplines look at it and start to think about it. I was really excited about the material that I gained on the use of evidence or the factual authorities, and I would love for that to get some traction because there's very little empirical evidence out there on the use of factual materials, and I think that it's very useful to practitioners, and I think it's something that scholars need to look at. So anybody out there who can send out the information to people in their communities, great. I think that would be wonderful. And I also hope that some of the more innovative methodological techniques that I used will also be picked up in both the judicial and more procedural communities. One of the things I did was build on a quantitative analysis that looks at citation counts. And I think that Edna has done some work in this field as well as others, counting up the number of legal citations to compare judicial awards and or judicial decisions and arbitral awards. And I used that because I wanted to build off of existing research. And I also made that more complex by looking at the types of authorities. But I also looked at, I created a more innovative approach to look, try to dig at some of the analytical questions that we were talking about on the panel. How much analysis is going into these decisions, meaning the jiving of law and fact, the application stage of IRAC, if you know that issue, rule, application, conclusion rubric. And I did that through a paragraph-by-paragraph analysis. So looking at the proportion of paragraphs that dealt with procedure, facts, law, analysis, conclusion, et cetera, and then looking at the proportions. And it was really quite interesting, and I would love to see more analysis like that, because I think that that does more than just a pure site count does. And I'll kind of leave it there and leave others to kind of jump in.
Yeah, no, I think that's important. I guess I had always thought, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong about where you came out, but I always thought that arbitrators really do reason, as you found, and do look to legal authorities, as you found, and do put in citations, as you found. But as compared to U.S. court decisions, I thought we put in many fewer citations for a particular point. So, you know, if you have the seminal case on point A, you're not going to do the string cite that the courts do. And so we would have fewer citations, but the fact that we have fewer would not really demonstrate any difference in the rigor of the analysis. So did that come out that way in yours or not really?
Yeah, and I don't remember the exact the exact count, but one of the things I did with the citation count was look at how many initial citations versus subsequent citations. So going through that concept of string cites, or just, you know, plopping in an authority and moving on and not really grappling with it versus digging deeply into analysis. And I asked this in both the surveys and interviews as well. And it was a logical answer, which is, if it's a new authority or a new novel issue of fact, we're going to go more in depth rather than just the string citing. And the arbitrators are much less likely to just string cite, although a number of judges said they hated string cites as well. So again, it's kind of everybody does a little bit of something, but I did try to get to that question.
So Stacey, what's your next research project going to be?
I was hoping somebody else would come in with that. I really want to get to that investment comparison to international commercial arbitration, because I think that's a big issue in our community right now. There's been, and part of the reason I did this study as well, is there's been a huge backlash against international arbitration, where commercial and investment are glommed together, to use the technical word, glom. And I think that they are a bit of a distinct creatures at this point. My only problem is doing all the statistical studies almost killed me. I realize Susan Frank is on this call because I did look at the attendees, but she does statistical studies all the time. God bless, because that stuff is mind-numbingly dull. And yet it's so important. So I would have to do some more statistical studies, and I'm just resisting it because it physically hurts to do that.
I had a question for you. There were two things that you said in your conclusion section that I thought were interesting. So one was that specialists in international dispute resolution might have a heightened regard for procedural justice as compared to those specializing in domestic disputes, which I thought was actually an interesting observation. And we can all think about why, because it's a private process. No, because it's international versus domestic. I don't know. I'd be interested in your thoughts as to why that would be. I guess something similar to that, judges and arbitrators both elevate process-oriented concerns over outcome-oriented concerns, which is sort of in the same ballpark as that other comment. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about your thinking about that and where those questions came from your research, because that is interesting.
It may be that the international, for your first issue, it may be that there are so many conferences in international commercial arbitration, and we are so often focusing on procedural issues that it may just be uppermost in internationalists' minds, whereas the domestic folks may not be thinking about all those issues in the same way, because they just don't have as many conferences. I mean, it's granted, but we know that, like, any day of the year you can find an international commercial conference somewhere in the world. With respect to the second question, the concept of process-oriented concerns versus outcomes, I think that that's a nice conclusion for all of us in the world of justice, which is we'll get to the right outcome if we follow the proper steps, that we're not trying to find that predetermined outcome and then justify it retroactively, which is what some people have alleged that judges do as well as arbitrators. But if we're thinking about how we get there, we will come to the correct outcome by eliminating or minimizing bias or unconscious and hidden prejudices. So I think that that's a good outcome. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was in the surveys, it came out that people across the realm followed or gave more heightened or more intense authority. They felt more strongly about the importance of procedural authorities, like the rules of either procedure or arbitration, than substantive authorities. And that was not expected. I didn't expect that the intensity, the heightened respect would be higher for these procedural authorities than for the substantive authorities. So I think more in that, because this analysis over the procedural and substantive line is not something I've seen before, but something that just kind of came up and was interesting to me. I do see we have a question in the Q&A, so let me just...
We do, yeah, and let me read that for everyone's benefit. And, you know, it actually goes to, again, your core findings, Stacey, and to what Edna talked about earlier. So the question is, there is much current discussion on the weighing of witness evidence and the credibility of recollections in contrast to document evidence. Do you see a convergence of approaches in arbitration? And maybe, Edna, I'll start with you because, you know, that's something I see you smiling, and that's something that you touched upon in your remarks earlier. So I'd be curious to hear what you think.
Well, there has been a lot written recently about the inaccuracy of recollection and how it really can be shaped by so many extraneous factors as people try to review what happened. But I think, you know, bottom line, you only have what you have to work with. So I think, you know, Stacey's work demonstrated that people thought that to the extent they thought oral testimony was important, it was important because it gave context and color to the documents. And, you know, reading documents in many cases cold, yes, sometimes they're dispositive, but, you know, often you really sort of need the story that goes with it. And I guess what I found a little bit surprising about the experience that I discussed was the transcript from the hearing was ignored until I pointed out what was in it, because there were some very important statements made there. But they did look at the witness statements, which really weren't done by the people at all. I mean, those were just done by the counsel, I would assume. You know, they were very well done. I mean, both sides did an excellent job of presenting their cases. I don't mean to diminish anybody's role or the arbitrators, who also did a great job. But it was just a very different way of approaching it. So is this going to change now? Are the people that are accustomed giving value to oral testimony going to do it less because of these recent revelations, which I guess we always sort of knew, but we didn't focus on them, that witness testimony is not so reliable? I don't think it's going to change all that quickly, really. I think, you know, we're used to hearing people and having them flush out the story for us. And for the most part, they're not intentionally lying. I don't think they're talking about people that are intentionally lying. So it's the framing of the story through time, through the way people prompt your recollection, the way the documents are presented to you with an explanation, perhaps. You know, we don't coach witnesses. But, you know, there's an art to how to do that appropriately, and in some cases, I'm sure, also influence what is said without intentionally coaching a witness, I'm sure. I don't know. I don't do counsel work anymore. I'm far away from that. But anyway, I think bottom line, no, I don't think it's going to change very much because of that. I think we all kind of knew that once anyway.
Yeah, I agree with that. And Judith, not to make you our designated speaker from a civil law perspective, but I wonder what your take is on that.
Yeah, I actually was hoping to be able to jump in, because I was thinking that this ties in quite nicely with one debate that is going on right now in connection with the pandemic and the fact that we are not having physical hearings anymore, and we are only having remote hearings like now. And depending on the legal cultures, again, those cultures where, like the Scandinavian tradition, where it is very important to, normally, a lot of weight is given to the oral witnesses and the oral testimony. And if an arbitrator or even a judge has to choose between believing a witness who is standing there and talking to him, or taking into consideration a document, they will choose the witness because they think that this is more immediate, this is more live, and this is more creditworthy, simply. And now they are having difficulties because now they feel that they trust very much their own ability to divine whether the person who is witnessing is saying, telling the truth, whether she is accurate or not. And they believe that by not being in the same room with them and by only seeing them on the screen, they are losing a lot of the, I don't know, energy or whatever, karma or whatever it is that they rely on to understand and to appreciate whether they are accurate or not. But this is a very interesting development right now, that the lack of hearings in presence is forcing to question the value of the witness evidence.
Well, I have to say, despite this talk being virtual as opposed to in person, I did find everything everyone said, you know, very credible and very impressive. So really, really appreciate, you know, everyone taking the time at whatever hour of the day it was. Thank you so much, Reka, for organizing. I think we're right on the cusp of you know, your time cut off. This was a fascinating program. Thank you so much, Stacey, for joining us. Thank you so much for the delegates for joining us and to our panelists. It was wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Well, then allow me to close us out and say thank you to our phenomenal panelists, Lilia, for not only keeping us on time, but thoughtfully adept through our different topics. To the audience for tuning in, join me in giving applause to each of our panelists. And please visit the link, purchase Stacey's book, and take a look at the supplemental reading where our panelists have each contributed some really thoughtful additions from what we've talked about today. With that, we will sign off, everyone. Have a phenomenal evening, morning, midday, wherever you are. Thanks so much.
Take care, thanks.
Bye, thank you.